Okay. Shh, you've got to be a bit quiet. It's because I'm podcasting.
Welcome to the Writer and the Critic Quarantine Edition. We are a formerly monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. And who knows how long we're doing this for now. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. Joining me on Skype, because we no longer care about quality, is Ian Mond. Hi, Ian.
Hello.
Stop it.
Did you see what I just did there?
You're in a truck. Is that what's happening there?
No, that's the static that comes through Skype.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that for the whole episode.
No, you're not. How are you?
Very good. So do you remember when we last did an episode?
December, I believe you have it in. December 2017. It's almost two and a half.
Who were our last books?
Oh, well, we talked about Bren McDibble's two books. So How to Be, and then under her YA writing name, Callie Black, Dark Places. And they were both really good. And that was a really good episode to go out on. And then a couple of weeks ago, you emailed me and said, hey, should we do this again?
Yeah, so let's be honest. We were never going to restart the podcast.
We were not.
Never. But COVID-19 came along, and I was listening to a podcast called Backlisted, which I will be speaking a bit more about later, and they were doing a bunch of podcasts called Locklisted, where they were just talking about shit that they liked, and I thought we could do the same thing. In other words, copy from them mercilessly. Because it's a great podcast.
Well, because no one ever does a podcast just about things that they like. So it is a unique concept that we would steal.
Correct. No one's ever done this before.
No, it was actually funny. I just realized you didn't email me. You texted me. I remember I was in bed and I got the text from you and I said to Jason, oh, God, he wants to do another Writing Critic. I don't think so. I'll leave this to the morning to reply. I don't think I want to do it. And, like, I think within about 15 minutes I texted you back going, well, what would we talk about?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So what are we going to talk about, Ian? Because we haven't – we normally, for those of you who may or may not have listened to us before, and if you haven't, I have no idea how you found this, but we would pick two books, a book each, or in our last year that we did it, we were kind of curating two books that we'd sort of choose together on a theme, and we'd announce them the previous podcast so people could read them if they didn't want spoilers, because we spoiled the shit out of them, and then we talk about them. But obviously this is a surprise quarantine edition, so we haven't told anyone we're doing this, so no one's got to prepare. So what are we doing this month, Ian?
So we're going to choose five things that are making us happy at the moment, because we all need to be a little bit happy.
Oh, happy at the moment. I didn't think that was the brief.
Oh, okay. Well, happy in the past, pre-COVID and post-COVID happy, and current COVID happy. Whichever. I know what I'm choosing.
Yeah, okay. No, I can do that. I don't know about the happy part. That's not my brain.
Okay. Okay. Five things that are making you miserable, happy, and fascinated. How's that? Fascinated.
Five things I have enjoyed.
Yeah, look, it doesn't – yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, okay, cool.
I'll be honest, I did try to find five things that had nothing to do with coronavirus, and that I failed. So –
okay. Well, mine – I guess – yeah, mine aren't. No, mine aren't. So that's – there we go.
Well, you win because I failed.
That's all right. I didn't get that brief either, so.
What are you trying to say, that I didn't explain the whole concept of this quarantine episode
we
clearly enough?
Flying by the seat of our pajama pants.
You would have thought after 68 episodes you'd have got used to how this thing goes.
Are you wearing pajama pants?
No, I'm actually properly dressed. Oh, I don't know why.
I'm wearing pajama pants.
Are you? Do you want me to show you what pants I'm wearing? No.
I don't think you – I don't know if you can get your leg up that high. Also, as always, this podcast is an audio podcast. Yeah.
Although we can see each other.
Yeah, you and I can see. Well, we always could, because you used to. This is the most rambling of rambling beginnings. Oh, before we go on, though, I do just want to give a shout-out to Galactic Suburbia, who in a way are responsible for this podcast, because when they started 10 years ago, you got all excited about doing a podcast. And so then eventually we started with this one. But they have wrapped up their regular podcasting. They may be back intermittently for various things, but after 10 years, they have lain down their microphones, and who can blame them after 10 years?
Because we gave up after five, didn't we?
Something like that. But yeah, so I really, really enjoyed their podcast. I didn't miss an episode. Sometimes I listen to them a few weeks late, but I listened to every episode and they were great. And so Alex and Elisa and Tansy, we'll miss you, but kudos to calling it at a time when you probably should have, because 10 years, yeah, wow, you guys are awesome, but you must have been getting tired.
And they just got nominated for a Hugo.
And they just got nominated for a Hugo, which is awesome. So congratulations. You think
this episode of our podcast could...
No. Yeah, not this episode, I don't think.
I was just wondering.
Okay.
You're starting.
I'm starting. Oh, my God. Stop. Okay. Jimmy. All right, whatever. Okay, well.
Yes,
so
start.
I'm going to start. So what I did was I just thought about things that I've sort of, you know, done the last couple of years since we recorded last. And I've come up with three books and a TV show, and then actually a couple of podcasts, but they're very short podcasts, so I grouped them together. But I'm going to start with one of the books because I have a confession to make. Oh, first of all, an announcement. I'm a doctor.
Hey!
So literally on Thursday the 9th, I conferred. So I am now Dr. McDermott, which still
sounds
weird.
Are you shitting
weird.
Me? It's 2 days ago.
2 days ago, I know. Like, I just got the email. So I haven't got the certificate or anything yet, but done. Thesis is done. Done. We're done, people. But since I finished my PhD, thank you. Thank you. And even during the last year or so of the PhD, when I was mainly working on the exegetical stuff, I wasn't really reading a lot of fiction. I started a few books and abandoned a lot of them, but I didn't really read a lot, and I haven't read a lot since I finished and submitted in December either. And I think I want that to change. But it was like when I was trying to think of the books I've read in the last 2.5 years, I'm like, oh my God, barely anything. So what I've done though, there were a couple of books that I did read, and I know they were good books because I finished them. Like, unlike the dozen or so others that I started and are on my bedside table with a bookmark in there somewhere that I just haven't got back to. So I wanted to talk about one which I know you've read because you reviewed it on Locus. So it's Helen Marshall's The Migration, which is her first novel. And we did at least one of her collections on the podcast. We did Hairside, Fleshside. I don't know if we did her second collection. I read it, which is great, but I don't think we did it on the podcast.
No,
but
we did Hairside, Fleshside.
But yeah, The Migration is a debut novel, and it is astonishingly good. Like, it is so good. And it as I said, I finished it. Yay. It's one of the probably books I can count on one hand that I finished in the last 18 months. And no, it is really, really good. So I guess if anything of that I've chosen to talk about, this is quasi pandemic related, but preemptively. So it's not about COVID or anything like that, but it is about climate change and about a mysterious plague which begins to affect young people that may or may not be related to. We're not spoiling any of these, I don't think, because we're doing really short.
It's mentioned the first 20 pages.
But yeah, so kind of a plague that is affecting young people in very strange ways and may or may not be affected, related to climate change or being caused or affected by climate change. Yeah, that's like your thumbnail sketch of that book, and it's about so much more. It's like, I love the relationship between the protagonist, who is she's 17, I think, and her younger sister, who's about 10, gets this plague virus condition thing, and it's about their relationship and what her older sister does to protect the younger sister's Kira and the older sister's Sophie, and it's sort of about what Sophie does to protect her younger sister and to ultimately save her in in the only way she can be saved at that point. And it's such a good book, but it's really, I don't know, it's really smart. I loved the Black Death things that Helen Marshall weaves through.
Yeah, I was going to mention that because it does have all that Black Death stuff, which is very very of the moment. prescient, but of the moment.
And there was the bit I love most, and I'm not going to spoil it, but there's a part of the book which Sophie gets hold of a medical report that was or a study that was done on some of these children. And so it's written as this report by one of the doctors who was doing this study and what happened to those. And you have to, it kind of keeps making you remember that they're only children, that, you know, adults aren't affected by this. This is, if I remember correctly, it's actually mostly prepubescent.
Yes.
That very young, not teenagers even. Sort of Sophie's kind of safe because she's older. So there's no kind of fear through the book that Sophie's going to get it or anything like that. But so this study is being done on these children who have this condition and what has or happened, has or hasn't happened to them. And it made that one section just made me so angry and so upset. It was really distressing because, you know what I'm talking about, Ian, because of what happened.
Yeah, I know.
As I said, it's written as this medical report, but the emotion that has come through from the doctor who's being forced to do certain things, and it just made me so angry. But it was such an interesting way to get this, because it's a first person narrative, and it's such an interesting way to get this other perspective into a book which otherwise is a book narrated by a 17-year-old. So you would otherwise be limited by what information you can get in there. But it was a really clever way to insert this and get this other perspective. And it, as I said, it just that particular bit made me very angry and very sad, and I hated Helen Marshall a little bit for writing it because it was super distressing.
But well, it was really one of my best books of last year. It was on my locus.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. So that is a highly, highly, highly recommend. I kind of feel like rereading it again now. Because part of the thing when you get into a reading slump is you just want to go back and read a book you know you've liked, because then you'll probably finish it.
Yeah, I'm in a reading slump as well, but we'll get to that.
So that's my first one, The Migration by Helen Marshall, which is, it's about a year old now, so it's available everywhere in paperback and e-readers and so on. So highly, highly recommend, and in a weird way, kind of, pandemic reading.
So I'll do mine. So I've chosen actually only one book. I've actually chosen a book, two podcasts, a YouTube channel, and Twitter. So not Twitter as a whole. I'll start with the YouTube channel. Everyone should be watching this, including you, Kirsten.
Okay. What's
so
the channel?
It's John Krasinski.
Oh, my
started,
God, no, that's amazing. I love that.
Oh, I mean, finished. Is this one of your five?
No, it's not, but.
Okay. So John Krasinski decided to start his own news channel called Some Good News, which, by the way, has 1.6 million subscribers right now. So this is not exactly a niche product that no one's heard of.
It's so awesome.
Yeah, it is. So it's just did its second episode, which everyone has probably seen a section of, because that from that is where there's this 9 or 10-year-old kid called Aubrey who misses out on having to see Hamilton because and so Krasinski with Lin-Manuel gets the cast of Hamilton to do one of the songs, all of them. It's amazing. Anyway, it's not about Hamilton, the show. It is essentially trying to report on good news that's happening in amongst coronavirus. So it is purely positive. The first episode had this hilarious interview with Steve Carell. So that was wonderful. But also it's just all these little stories that Krasinski has found on the interwebs that he's just talking about. And he seems like he's about to break into tears about every 3 minutes.
Break into tears every 3 minutes watching it.
Exactly. It's got this, his daughters did the logo, which is just a big SGN with painted in multicolor. It starts with a globe spinning around, which he's holding. It's like it's been done on a budget, clearly, of $2.50, but it is so, so beautiful, so heartfelt. And, yes, I'm extremely cynical. And I know, Kirsten, you're very dark. very, very dark.
I am. But this show is amazing.
This gets through all the darkness. It's just it's a ray of light. So I highly recommend you sign up with 1.6 million other people.
Yes.
It's actually only number 24 on YouTube in terms of trending, which is pretty poor in my view. Some good news.
I would have thought number 24 out of all of YouTube was pretty damn good.
True. and Kirsten, you'd like to know that he records it all on Zoom.
Does he?
It's all done on Zoom.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure everyone probably records their own sides and feeds it. Anyway, we won't need to get into that. But no.
How much do you like Zoom, Kirsten?
It's not a particular platform. It's just the amount of remote conversations I've had to have because I'm just done. Very done. I mean, I should say I'm incredibly lucky. I have a job that I can continue doing at home and get paid my regular salary for. That's amazing. But, you know, it's also doing the job at home is quite frustrating because connectivity and Zoom meetings and it's not quite the job that I can do when I'm at the office. So, but, you know, they're trying to change a whole bunch of stuff and get us a bit more up to speed. So that'll be good. But no, I'm incredibly lucky I have the job. But yes, very, very weary of the remote stuff at the moment. And the idea that this might go on for a few months is like, oh my God.
I'm there with you. But anyway, some good news will break through the misery.
It will. And, you know, it's like the Hamilton bit, because I'm not one of the Hamilton people, obviously.
I couldn't care less about Hamilton.
But, oh, my God, that came on and it was like, oh, this is really cool. And then as it went on and went on, I had tears pouring down my
cheeks. The reaction from the young girl, Aubrey, just her constant, oh, my God, look. And you just can't. Yeah. I feel emotional just talking about it. It's amazing.
It was so cool. No,
but don't just watch that bit on YouTube, people. No, watch the whole thing. They go for 17 minutes, the episodes.
They're not that long. It's not like he's there for an hour. There's not that much good news in the world.
Okay, you're number two.
Okay,
it's not that much good news.
There's 17 minutes a week, people. That's what we've got. You can make the time. Okay,
what's your next one?
I'm going to go back to, it's one of my PhD books, and it's just really good, and it reminded me when I was looking through the things that I had read. Obviously, I had read a lot of PhD stuff, and there was some stuff which was good, but I hadn't read one of the difficulties of my PhD was actually there wasn't like a whole collection of stuff that was like I could look at that collection. So I was tending to be picking the eyes out of things. But there's a really, really good collection that I read for my PhD, and it's called Mother's Grimm by Danielle Wood. She's an Australian author, and it's four novellas plus a fifth sort of introductory story, which talks about good mothers. But basically what Danielle Wood's done is taken four fairy tales. There's a Rapunzel one, there's a Sleeping Beauty one, and there's a Hansel and Gretel one. And most people will know Rapunzel and Sleeping Beauty because, you know, they're two that Disney did. I always thought Hansel and Gretel was a really well-known one, but I found there's a lot of people who weren't aware of what that tale was. So that's the two children who get abandoned in the forest and go to the Wicked Witch in her gingerbread house. That's what people know.
People don't know what Hansel and Gretel is.
Yeah, apparently a few people don't know, or maybe they don't know the title, but when you say the gingerbread house, they're like, oh, yeah, okay, that one. And then there's another one which is based on the Goose Girl, which is a story a lot of people may not be familiar with. But anyway, so these four plus one novellas, they're really good. They're focusing on, as you'd guess from the title, Mother's Grimm, on motherhood. So all of the stories are dealing with a woman or a young girl who is a mother or going to be a mother or has, you know, that kind of a relationship. And the Hansel and Gretel ones, I think, actually is my favorite because it's – I mean, none of these stories are happy.
In fact,
it's really funny. The title on the cover, the little tagline that they've got there is wickedly dark, astonishingly funny, happy endings not guaranteed. And I remember having a Twitter conversation because I was on Twitter at the time, I think with I can't remember who actually, who'd also just ordered this book, and we had this little conversation, and I said, yeah, I think my funny bits fell out in the post because I didn't get the funny bits. Like, it's really not, it's not funny. There's some dark sort of wry humor, in there. But it's not what you'd call, I don't think, astonishingly funny. It's like, but they're really good. And the Hansel and Gretel one, which is called, you know what? That's terrible. I can't think of the name of that particular story. I'm just going to have a very quick look. It's called Cottage. There we go. It's called Cottage. So the Hansel and Gretel one is, the setup is sort of the, so the Wicked Witch becomes a woman who's in daycare. Like a daycare provider, and the mother, it's told from the, like, who would be, she's the actual mother, not a stepmother. A lot of people, in a lot of the stories of Hansel and Gretel, it's a stepmother who convinces the father to abandon the children in the woods. In the original Grimm version, it was a mother, like a biological mother, and the Grimms kind of changed that through a few iterations because it's not good for a mother to do that, so they made her a stepmother instead.
But, I didn't know that, but okay.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So this is the mother of children who has to go back to work, and so she has to put her child into childcare, and that's kind of related to abandoning the child in a forest. But the childcare worker is not a wicked witch. She's just, you know, she's a very good childcare worker. It's just the boy ends up bonding to her and hating his mother for abandoning him to childcare. And it's such a fantastic story. It's complex, and you know what Danielle has done with all of these fairy tales, all four of them that she's looked at, is she's reconfigured them in a really interesting way. So the one that's based on the Goose Girl actually took me a little while to realize what, oh no, sorry, the one that was based on Sleeping Beauty took me a little while to realize it was a Sleeping Beauty story, because she's, yeah, like kind of tilted it really dramatically.
Oh, so it's not overtly clear,
no,
from the get-go.
No, I think I mean, none of them need, you don't need to know their fairy tale story. They're all just really, really good novelettes. They're really good stories. And if you know that they're coming from this particular fairy tale story, then you get some extra stuff in there. But they're just really, really good stories. Dark, but really, really good about, you know, motherhood and being a mother and having been a mother. And yeah, they're great. So that's
when did it come out?
I want to say it was right near the beginning of when I started. Like, I was not too far into it. 2014. There we go. So yeah, right near the beginning, maybe even slightly before I began my PhD. That came out. It was one of the very first ones I read, but it's really, really good. And you don't have to necessarily know anything about fairy tales to enjoy this book. But that does obviously add an extra layer of thinking about what she's done to the fairy tale and how she's turned it into a story. And I'll also add, they're all very contemporary stories, so they're all set now among people who are living today. So she's not trying to rework them back into sort of a fairy tale mode, but they're fantastic. So that is a highly, highly recommend.
I'll move to mine.
Yes, second one. Yes.
I'll be very quick on this one. It is simply, okay, so there is a dearth of leadership out there in the world at the moment.
Really? Wow.
Yes, I don't know if you've noticed, but one leader who I'm very impressed with and who's worth following on Twitter and Facebook is the Premier of Victoria, Daniel Andrews.
Oh, my God, right?
He's fantastic.
He's amazing.
So even people I know who wouldn't vote Labor in a million years, so on the left here in Australia,
yeah,
have said how good he is. So, and it's because Andrews sort of was as was told to me, he was very much involved in was it Black Friday, the bad one that we had, not the most recent
Black Saturday.
I always get it confused. You think I wouldn't?
The one out at King Lake and so on.
Correct.
Yep.
And that really scarred him, apparently, how badly the state responded and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So he, when it comes to crises, he mobilises straight away. So he did it with the bushfires 3 months ago. Do you remember the bushfires? Does anyone remember there were bushfires? Do you remember that there was smoke choking us weeks on end?
Completely. That was December, January. That was fun. And November too, actually, I think.
Yeah, that was 3 months of hell. And we went outside for that one. So he mobilized really quickly for that. And in terms of coronavirus, he has been very, very good because, as in the case of America, the states play a large role in Australia in terms of implementing restrictions, et cetera. So he, unlike our federal government, who has been extremely poor at communicating basic information, Dan Andrews is getting onto Facebook nearly every day saying exactly what the situation is and, you know, where we're at and just being as clear as possible.
Yeah, no, his communication is excellent.
Correct. And being funny as well from time to time. So yesterday someone took a photo of him making a fritter.
I know.
Did you see that one?
I did. But that wasn't what I liked about that was, yeah, so it's just a photo. Actually, it's kind of weird because it's a photo of him just at his kitchen stove cooking one fairly small fritter in quite a large pan.
That's all he's doing.
And I'm looking at it going, that's not how you cook fritters. And that doesn't seem like he knows how to cook fritters. And then he's got a little comment right underneath it that says, full disclosure, my wife actually did most of the work and the kids are doing the cleaning up. It's like, oh, that's awesome. Owning up to the publicity staged photo. That's really cool.
Yeah. So look, has he been perfect? No. Is anyone perfect? No. But he's been far better than most. So I want to give a shout out to our premier of our state, Victoria. And look, I understand that Gladys, I can't pronounce her second name, the premier in New South Wales.
Yep.
She's done a very good job as well, but I don't live in New South Wales, so I'm just getting a point to Sir Dan Andrews. He deserves a knighthood after what he's done last 5 months. if you're into knighthoods,
yeah. No,
so that's my second.
No, I've been not on Twitter. I've been I have had him on Facebook, and he's turned up on my Facebook feed quite a bit. And yeah, it's just very clear communication and, you know, succinct. And we have, you know, we have a lot of restrictions at the moment, as a lot of people do, about what you can and can't do. And I did like the little, he had this sort of, well, he, the government, the state government, brought out this little series of sort of tiles, like little FAQ things. Can I do this? With a very, very simple, often one word answer. And that answer was often no. And there was just these very factual things, but there was this vein of kind of good humor through them, I think. And that's something that's, I think, the Andrews government has been doing very well, is that with a lot of the communication, there's a vein of sort of humor that runs through it. Not like funny, ha ha, just like we, you know, good humor. Like we get how hard this is and we're trying to do what we can. And sometimes we get asked silly questions and we will answer them, but we will not necessarily be straight faced in our answers.
And I should point out, and I'm going to pat myself on the back here, because I don't do that often enough.
No, you don't. You really don't. You're very hard on yourself.
But it's not just me. Everyone should be – look, you just said before you were lucky to have a job, and so am I. I'm a public servant. I work for the Department of Transport. And it is the public servants, led by their ministers and premiers across the world, not just in Victoria, who are mitigating many of the problems that are going on. So as idiot leaders make stupid statements, it's often the public servant that has to clean up. So, yes,
yeah,
health workers are obviously key to this, and people who are doing courier work and blah, 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 blah. But I know on my side, in terms of freight, which is an essential task, I've had to do, and me and my team have had to do a lot of work just to get freight moving to supermarkets, dunny paper, all that stuff, you know. Yeah. So that's toilet. and it only happens if you've got good public service that can deliver that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, well, I mean, I'm a public servant too now. And yeah, we're trying to work through stuff, and our capacity is obviously diminished with everyone working from home and not having the resources or the infrastructure that we would normally have. But yeah, everyone's working very hard to try to get things up to a higher level of service as we can, as soon as we can. But yeah, it's including like one of our top managers is spending his Easter weekend driving around in his car, dropping off mobile phones to people's houses here in Ballarat so we can use them next week for the next phase of what we're able to do. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's really, it's, I mean, And again, we're not frontline at all, Ian. We're safe in our house doing what we can do. It's just the people who are out there in the hospitals and the people who are in the supermarkets, and like they're out there at risk far more than than we are, like going running in once or twice a week to get our stash of groceries and then scuttling back home again, and they're there every day, you know, interacting with people. And
and my Uber Eats guy, he seriously,
exactly,
all those guys,
you know, and getting paid very little money to do so. I'm really hoping not, you know, I don't know if anyone's noticed over the years that I'm a bit of a left-wing socialist. I'm just really, really hoping that we come out of this at the other end, and the more prolonged this is, the worse people are going to have it by the end. And I hope we come out with a much better idea of what social safety nets do and who they're for, and possibly maybe a bit more robust. I mean, certainly, I don't know, there's a lot of talk now, more talk than I've seen in the last decade, about like universal basic income and how that should just be there. So, yeah, I don't know. We can hope. We can hope that there might be good social policies that come out of this and policies that provide a bit more accessibility. Because one of the other interesting things that I've not participated in the conversations because I don't think it's really my part, but I've been listening to a lot of the conversations from people who have disabilities or are disability advocates, remarking on how amazing and confusing it is to see half the workforce suddenly mobilized for remote access and all of this stuff that, you know, if you have a disability, you would have maybe loved to have been able to work remotely and have a job that would allow you to do that. And because so many jobs have accessibility issues, and so they're not open to people who can't necessarily get into an office and do that job. And suddenly half the country is like, oh, we can do this from home, and here's all your remote tools to do that in, and you can do that from your chair, and you can do that from your bed. And yeah, I've seen a lot of conversations around disability about, hey, we've been asking for this for a few decades now, and you kept telling us how impossible it was, and we would just have to not have a job. And yeah,
there is a deep mistrust about working from home. So the tools have always existed.
Yeah.
Though there's not been much investment in them, the VPNs, because, like, for example, when we started working from home, the VPN fell over after about 3 minutes.
Oh, it took me a week to get connected. Like, it was the VPN that we're using. I don't know if it's the same one. A Victorian government might be the exact same one. It was meant to be running about, around 20,000 people at any one time. And suddenly the whole Victorian government went, we need to sign on, and the network went, fuck you.
Exactly. And that's because there's a major distrust about people working from home.
Yeah.
No one, because we're not working.
Yeah.
But we're clearly watching Netflix while we're meant to be working. That's what
I
people above think.
I have watched less Netflix these past month than I have.
I've barely watched
the
stream.
The last thing I want to do when I get up from
too many people are outside in Netflix shows. Have you noticed?
It's so funny. We watched, and this is a recommend too from left field. This is an extra recommend. We watched Eye in the Sky last night on Netflix. It's a movie with Helen Mirren and Alan Rickman. It's possibly one of his last movies. It was definitely in post after he died. But yeah, and it was one. It's a look at a targeted attack on a city in Nairobi, not a city, a house in Nairobi where there's some terrorism happening, and that's a very, very, very light sketch of what it is. And it's such a good movie. It's so much better than I thought it would be. It's really, really good, and it asks a lot of difficult questions, and it doesn't give you any answers. And it's really well acted. But there's this bit with Alan Rickman is sort of he plays a general who's overseeing one part of the mission, and he's just sort of talking about how we do these things from a distance, but you're still there. And the whole movie was about people working remotely and on a situation that had very real consequences on the people on the ground. And the flowback effects on the people who were behind computer screens and so on. And it was just really good to see that it wasn't just the idea that if you're just behind a computer screen, you're not actually connecting with people and you don't feel things and everything is disconnected. It was really It's a really good movie. So that's a recommend, that movie, actually. That was a great movie.
Yeah, but are there people outside in the movie?
There are people outside in the movie, but they're the people who are getting killed.
Okay.
But there was this bit which was interesting, because at the end when it's all wrapped up, because everyone's just around it, like people are around various tables and in control booths and everything for most of the movie, and they're the people we're watching.
Oh, okay, yeah, gotcha.
But at the end it's all kind of finished and they're packing up and going away, and they start shaking hands, and Jason and I looked at each other, don't shake hands, what are you doing, stop shaking hands. Because until that point it felt kind of normal. No one was touching, no one was like with very close to each other. And then suddenly everyone is shaking hands. It's like, no, stop.
That's the one thing Dr. Fauci wants to come out of this, that no one ever shakes hands again.
He's
been dead serious about that, not joking.
I'd be happy with that. Handshaking is also a very anxious thing, because you don't know how hard to shake the hand. If you've shaken the hand too hard and then you get someone who is not a hard handshaker, and then you feel like you've been too hard with your handshake, but then if you don't, and it's always weird, whenever a man shakes my hand and he does that really limp handshake, I'm never sure if he's done that just because I'm a woman. So it's funny, because we'll often, like if Jason and I are together and we meet someone and they shake hands, and I'll ask Jason later, it's like, how did he shake your hand? was it soft or was it hard? He goes, oh, it was a pretty soft handshake. I was like, okay, good, that's fine, because that's what he did to me as well. It's very all anxious right. making. I'd be very happy to dispense with the entire handshake.
Kill it off altogether. Completely. Does that segue into your third thing? Notice how I'm pushing you onto
third
your third
thing. Yes. Okay, sure. I do have another book, but I'm just going to skip, because we've this is probably one of your things. It might be one of your things. I don't know. It's probably one of like millions of people's things. But one of the things which I kept me very happy and very entertained, and I need to do it an entire rewatch again at some point, is The Good Place.
It isn't one of my things, but I highly endorse what you're about to say. Yeah, so yes.
I love this show so much. It's one of my absolute all-time favorite shows ever. It is clever and smart and funny, and it is full of human emotion and stupidity and ridiculousness and, you know, bravery and all of those things. And it is just so good. And it's funny.
One of the best finales ever.
Oh my God.
We're not going to say
anything. But yeah, it's so good. And it's funny, because when I first started watching it, when it first came out, and I thought I'd only watched two or three episodes, and then I stopped, because I thought, it would be a show Jason would like. And so we did want shows we could watch together. So if I came across a show that I started watching and I thought, oh, Jason might actually like this, I would stop and then we'd watch it again and see if he did like it. And I really thought I'd only watched two or three episodes and thought, oh, Jason might like this. And then when I went back and we started watching it together, I'd watched the whole of the first season. I just for some reason I thought that the flip, like the first reveal, had happened only after like a couple of episodes. And you hadn't worked through an entire season before you got to the flip. So yeah, it's very easy to watch, I think is what I'm saying. It's very easy to just sit down on your couch and watch The Good Place.
It is, but it's also genuinely philosophical. I mean, it is. As someone who may have studied philosophy at uni,
yeah,
all the stuff about utilitarianism and the different philosophers that they drag in throughout each season, it's all real. It's all well-researched. It's been well thought through.
Yeah. No, it's just such a good show. Like I said, I want to watch, because I suspect – in fact, I know that there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff that once you know the whole show, you'll just pick up these little things all the way through, because it's so cleverly written, but not in a way that it's like, it's not clever. It's just smart. It's just really, really smart television, and just really easy to watch. And everyone who's cast in it is just, they do such a good job with their characters. And yeah, I just love it. I really, really genuinely love it so much. And yeah, the trolley problem is, which I'd known about before The Good Place, but that one episode where they illustrate the trolley problem—it's
that is genius. That episode, that is Pure genius. Brilliant.
It's kind of caused that to just sink into my head now. And actually, I was watching the ABC.
Well, just how macabre and absurd it is, and right. But also correct.
Also correct. But also, like, I mean, as you would know, Ian, being a master of philosophy.
You're the doctor, I'm the master. The
no.
I didn't even plan that.
No. Can we never, ever, ever say that again, please?
Never. Never
again. Well, what I liked about The Good Place, one of the many things I liked about The Good Place was it didn't propose to have all the answers to things. Like a lot of it was just about there are no answers and you find your best way. And I was really genuinely worried when we were up to the last two or three episodes. I was sort of like I said to Jason, I don't know how they're going to end this. Like I can't see a satisfying way for them to end this. I'm really concerned. Because you know me, if like something doesn't end well, it almost ruins the whole thing.
I do know you, and yes, I know.
But yes. The ending, and I won't say what it was, but it was perfect for that show. It was perfect. And I have to say, like, I'm an atheist and I don't actually believe in an afterlife or anything. And this whole show is predicated on the idea of there is an afterlife. You know, they don't call it heaven and hell. It's the good place and the bad place. But the idea is that there is something after you die. And it was interesting because the way it ended and some of the, I guess, conversations that were had in the last episode were like, they almost had their cake and ate it too. Like it was really, really good. And I actually genuinely found it a really comforting episode, I think.
I really like how you're weaving around spoilers here.
I really don't want to spoil it for people because it's very such a good show. But I genuinely found it like really, really comforting. And there's one particular line which you probably know that Chidi says. And it's just like he says this one line to Eleanor to explain something and to comfort her. And Jason and I looked at each other. We both had tears just streaming down our cheeks. It's such a good show. I unequivocally recommend it. It's really, really good. And I will do a rewatch probably sooner rather than later if we remain in lockdown for months.
So my third thing is a podcast, one of two podcasts, and that is I highly recommend this. There's a lot of shit being said about – I guess it's more about coronavirus. There's a lot of shit being said about the virus, so you really need to listen to the Science Versus podcast.
Oh, Science Versus. So
there was the Australian – it used to be on in Australia. It was an ABC podcast.
Yes.
And then Wendy Zukerman moved to America and Gimlet Media took it over. And they've been doing it now for a few years. Mm. So it's not about COVID. It's about Science Versus
But at the moment gun. They're doing a bit of COVID.
Correct. So every two or three days they post a short episode that deals with everything from – Hydroquorilox, whatever that stupid drug is, the malaria drug. Not a stupid drug, a very good drug,
very
malaria.
Very good drug for malaria. May or may not have
efficacy for COVID-19. Yep. From that to just this, the one that they just posted yesterday was, when will it actually end, you know, all this restriction stuff. And they've had Fauci on and all that stuff. It's just in terms of cutting through the gobbets of shite that you hear every single day, it's very, very revealing. It's really good to do that because there's so many gobbets and there's so much shite and they're together, those gobbets of the shite. And so every time something pops up, usually out of Trump's mouth, they'll do an episode directly dealing with it. And you can then go onto their show notes and look at all the studies that they're referring to, of which there's often 70 to 80. Per episode.
Cool. I wasn't one of my ones I listened to all the time, but I did listen to a few episodes when it was on the ABC. So, and I always meant to get back to it when it went to Gimlet and I just never did. So maybe I'll put that on my list.
I also would get you to listen to the one about 5G.
Oh God, I just can't.
No, it's really good episode because it'll tell you things about 5G you probably didn't know. Okay. Not in a it's bad way.
I mean, the
conclusion spoilers, 5G is fine. But it's really, really informative just if you ever come across a fuckwit.
Do you remember when 4G was the bad thing?
Yeah.
Like,
and
it's
what's
the
interesting
same
about this
stories.
Is that 3G and 4G are marginally worse than 5G and neither are bad.
Yeah.
None of them are bad.
That's so, what I mean. Yes. Like, it's the same stories. It's like, but you said all this about 4G. You probably said it about 3G. I just don't remember.
I know. I mean, look, the episode could be 10 seconds long. It could say you get more electromagnetic radiation from the sun than you do from these technologies.
Yeah.
Drop mic, walk away. But no, they go into all the science behind 5G, okay. What it actually is. Because a lot of people don't even know what it is.
No,
I Because they see lots of little bases put up and they don't know why and what. Anyway, given that everyone's talking about it and linking it to COVID, that's also a great science versus episode.
I hadn't heard that. Really?
Yeah.
God, what is
5G is a genuine, clearly. It's connected to the coronavirus. That's they're vectors of one of the other.
Oh my God.
I don't
God.
Know if the coronavirus builds 5G stations or 5G millimeter waves cause coronavirus. I can't remember which of them. I don't know why I'm laughing because there are people who – John Cusack just wrote a tweet saying this.
John Cusack?
John Cusack, the actor who I respected as of a week ago.
Past tense respected.
Correct. Although apparently he's written weird shit. Did you see Pete Evans has got this $15,000 device?
He's just such a dick. I didn't think he could actually get worse with the whole anti-vaxxer crap and he's fucking, feed babies broth, bone broth, and that's all you need to. I just didn't think it could actually get worse. And then I saw this literally just last night.
He's hawking and it was $15,000 made up piece of crap. I think it makes tea.
It makes light. And it's got recipes for different things, including apparently coronavirus. Two of them. It makes light. It shines coloured light. Fuck off, Pete Evans.
Google, if you don't know who Pete Evans is, Google him and then you may have to vomit afterwards.
Stop. So, literally stop killing people. Literally stop it.
I know. It's just. All right. That's my third.
Okay.
What's your fourth, Kirsten?
Well, since you just talked about podcasts, I will talk about some podcasts. So, I've been listening to one of the things when I haven't been reading. What I have been doing is listening to a lot of podcasts, especially my job was based in Melbourne for a couple of months when I first started because I hadn't got our Ballarat premises up and running yet. So I had long train trips every day to and from, and I just didn't, I thought I would read and I just didn't read. It was too tiring. But I was listening to a lot of podcasts and it was good. And I've been listening to podcasts for years, but this was got me caught up on a few. And I've got two that I don't think I've mentioned before that I really, really love. And they're both short, which is great because now that I'm not on the train, the time to actually sit down and listen to podcasts is diminished. So short ones are really great. And so two of my very favorites that one of them I've been listening to since it started, and it's a few years old now, is The Illusionist. With Helen Zaltzman, and it's a language podcast.
Heard of it?
And it's,
I haven't listened
it's
to it.
It's fantastic, and they're usually quite. All the episodes are under 30 minutes, and most of them are actually usually under 15 minutes. So she's done a few longer ones, depending on the topic, but most of them are quite short, and they're just fantastic. And they're just, as I said, it's about language, it's about etymology, it's about issues and topics around language. It's not just like the history or development of language. It's a whole bunch of stuff. And she's funny and she's British. So her voice is great to listen to. And she's just,
What about the vocal fry, Kirsten? What's the vocal fry like?
I don't think she has vocal fry because she's British.
That's the most sexist bullshit, that vocal fry. Anyway, keep going.
Anyway, but no, so it is super funny. And like, as I said, there are dozens, if not hundreds of them up now. So they do seasons and then one comes out every week while a season is on. I really should have looked up how many episodes there were. But no, they are super funny. And she's done episodes on swearing. She's done episodes on – she did an episode on vocal fry, actually, I think. I'm pretty sure because it was about pronunciation and things like that. But yeah, no, they're just great. And you can just dip in anywhere. It's not like an ongoing thing. It's just you go through the list, pick a topic that looks interesting and listen. And like I said, they're mostly really short. So they're great to just, you don't have to like put an hour aside to listen to a podcast like, you do with this one.
Yeah, exactly. What's the second one?
And the second one, is one I only just started listening to a few months ago and it's called The Memory Palace. And the guy.
Oh, I've heard of that one. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And the guy who runs this is, Nate DeMayo, who has the best voice. I could listen to him recite a shopping list honestly. Like, I would just be more than happy to just listen to him read the dictionary, which Helen Zaltzman does at the end of every episode. She gives you a word that she literally finds physically by thumbing through a dictionary. But no, so the Memory Palace is, again, they're really short episodes. They're usually less than 20 minutes and some are quite short. And they're just these little vignettes from history. And he's done, like, I think about the amount of research he must have done.
161 episodes.
There you go. Is that the Memory Palace or is that The Illusionist, the Memory Palace?
Yes, yeah. His most recent episode is Stories to Wash Hands By.
Which is great. Stories to Wash Hands By. He did 20 second stories.
Oh, wow.
And so there are, each story is only a handful of sentences, but they're, and so, and some of them are funny, some of them are more poignant, but yeah, he did 20 second stories. But yeah, most of his podcasts are longer than 20 seconds, but shorter than about 20 minutes.
Yeah, I'm looking, they're 5 minutes.
Some of them are really, really short. Some of them are.
And like, it's just him talking. Yeah, it's not, he doesn't.
No,
interview.
No, he just tells you this story from history. And they're, like I said, they're sort of, I think of them as vignettes because they're all short and he's gone in. He doesn't give you he gives you enough background information so you understand who he's talking about and what the situation is. And he just tells you this story and they're really well written. They're like, he's not just talking like we're talking. He has written the script and he's read you this story. And they're about people who, in some cases, we really should have heard of, but haven't because they're women or they're people of color or they're both, or they're gay or, you know, they're some marginalized, they belong to a marginalized group. And so history has not been kind in, recording a lot about them, or if it has recorded a lot about them, it hasn't been gathered together and these people aren't famous like they, in some cases, should be. Or they're just little side stories about people or events that you do know a lot about, but this little story you may not know and you probably don't know. And I think about the amount of research that Nate DiMeo must put into each of these tiny little episodes and the amount of reading he must do and research and then he writing these beautiful literary poetic scripts. I mean, they're just a joy to listen to. It's the story is great, but the way he's written it and told you the story is just delightful. It's like one of those comes into my feed. It's like, oh my God, I can't wait. I need to listen to this now. Yeah, and no, they're short, I usually can just listen to it right now. And because what I was doing, what I used to do to listen to podcasts, I would have them on my computer while I was doing something else and they'd be playing. And then when I was on the train, of course, you can't just have your phone playing. So I dug out my headphones and was listening to it on the phone. And can I just say, both Helen Zaltzman, whose voice is awesome, but especially Nate DiMeo, when you're listening to their voice and they're just in your ears, it's amazing. So
is that like an ASMR or whatever that thing is called? You know, when you
not quite. It's just, but no, the way. But his voice is great, and the way he reads you the stories, he's very soft spoken and very, you know, he's just quietly, like he's just sitting next to you telling you a story, and they're fantastic. I can't recommend the Memory Palace highly enough. I haven't had a chance to go back and listen to all 161, but I will slowly work my way through them. And yeah, really, really highly recommended. And both of them short podcasts. You can fit them into your day because they're not, like I said, you don't have to put aside an hour or 45 minutes or something. So like some of the other ones I listen to that have fallen a bit by the wayside, I don't have a lot of time to listen to This American Life anymore, for instance, because it's an hour.
So why is anyone going to listen to this?
I don't know.
Okay, number four for me is a longer podcast, but I do take the time to listen to it because it's my favourite podcast. It's called Backlisted, which I actually mentioned at the end of our very last episode of The Writer and the Critic as a podcast people could listen to instead of listening to us.
Uh-huh.
And it has kept on going since 2017. They're up to now 108 episodes. And as I said before, they've in amongst COVID, they were taking a hiatus anyway for 3 months, but that 3 months included COVID. And so they did a few episodes called Locklisted where they basically did what we're doing right now, which was talk shit for an hour about things that they're enjoying. But the podcast is about to begin again, starting with Excellent Women by Barbara Pym will be the next episode, episode 109. But before that, there's 108 episodes, as I said, and that includes, I mean, their last episode before they went on hiatus was La Rèche de Tumpe, you know, Proust.
Oh, yeah.
The remembrance of things past for those. Yes. Search of lost time, whatever the hell it's called. Anyway, but I usually read along with them. So I've read books by Arnold Bennett, Patricia Highsmith, which was Edith's Diary, which is amazing. Have you read Edith's Diary?
I have not read any Patricia Highsmith.
Well, Edith's Diary is amazing. Seabold, The Rings of Saturn, which is also pretty damn good. I read Daphne du Maurier's The Breaking Point, which is a short story collection, which Yeah, no, that's pretty damn sweet. So these are the sort of books that they're doing. William Faulkner's Absalom, which did my head in. Elizabeth Taylor, not the actress, but the UK writer, The Soul of Kindness, which is extraordinary. Anyway, these are the sort of Werner Herzog's of Walking in Ice. These are the sort of books they do, and it's hosted by Andy Miller and John Mitchinson, both of whom have got pretty decent voices, and they don't choose the book. A guest comes in and chooses the book.
Oh, okay, nice.
And they are extremely well-read.
And it's one book per episode.
Yes, one book per episode, although generally Andy has read the author's entire oeuvre in preparation because he's a swot like that. And, yes, it's – yeah. So just to give a bit of background, Andy Miller every month would show how many books he's read, and often it would be 20 to 25 books he would read in a month. So this pissed lots of people off who'd get really insecure about not reading 20 to 25 books every month. And he wrote this wonderful article about what it means to why he's able to, because that's his job, and also how one shouldn't be afraid of being able to read lots of books.
You shouldn't be.
So anyway, yes, he does read lots, and he comes very well prepared, which means it's always a very – well-researched but very funny episode. And the first 15 minutes is devoted to what they're currently reading. So they've also got recs for new stuff. So, yes, really, really good. Highly recommend Backlisted, and you should be listening to it. And, in fact, it was the future podcast of the year 2019.
Okay. Well, actually, on that, I'll just throw in another quick one. There was a podcast – well, is a podcast I listen to called Criminal by Phoebe Judge makes that one. And it's actually on hiatus at the moment. But what she's doing is she's reading. She's just doing a reading. So she read I can't remember which one, but it was an Agatha Christie story. And now she's reading Hound of the Baskervilles. So they're out of copyright works, but she's just reading them in short bursts of, I think the Agatha Christie one took about 12 or 13 episodes of, you know, short. So it's not like hours and hours, but – and she's got – also has a really, really good reading voice. So if you're wanting some free books read to you, or older stories at least, and you like Conan Doyle, she's doing Hound of the Baskervilles at the moment, which I think I might listen to. I wasn't that interested in the Agatha Christie story, but the Hound of the Baskervilles I might go back and listen to. That's the podcast Criminal. So if you go to the Criminal feed – the readings that she's doing you'll be able to find them there. So my fifth thing is a book, and it's an astonishingly good book. It's The Mere Wife by Maria Davana Headley. Have you read this one, Ian?
No.
It is so good. It is the best non-PhD book I've read since we stopped doing the podcast. It is amazingly, amazingly good. So it's a Beowulf retelling in a way, but again, I'm not as familiar with Beowulf as I am with fairy tales, put it that way. But I do know the basic story and plot points and things. But I don't think you need to know, you don't need to be a Beowulf scholar or anything to enjoy the book. It's a really, really good novel.
I assume it has Grendel in it.
It has analogues for all of the main characters. The main character of Beowulf is obviously Beowulf, and he's barely in this book. His analogue is a police officer called Ben Wolf, who has
It's contemporary. It's a contemporary.
It's a contemporary book. It has and that police officer has a significant part to play, but it's not about him. It's actually about the woman who would be Grendel's mother. But it's also about the mother of another boy, and her analogue is that she was a character in the Beowulf story who was sort of the wife of the head of the Danes. So she was one of the hosts of Beowulf when he was staying at the hall and when he killed Grendel and so on. So, but the book is about these two mothers, and the mother of Grendel and then the mother of this other little boy who is in this big fancy gated community. So Gren is the name of the little boy who is the Grendel analog, and his mother is Dana, and she is an ex-soldier who has come back from the Middle East, where there apparently was like a video of her being beheaded, like captured and being beheaded by a terrorist group, but it must have not been, may or may not have been real, because she's come back to the US and she's hiding out in this mountain with her son who was born, and she may or may not have been raped to conceive this child. But it's about her and protecting her son and what she would do to protect him from the world. And then about this other woman, Willa, who's very, very well off, and she's sort of the matriarch of this gated community. And the community's done quite nicely. I mean, they're very wealthy people, and you hate a lot of them. And you kind of hate Willa, but you also sympathize with Willa and her position too, and her son Dylan. And so that you've got these two women, these two mothers who are opposed to each other. And for a lot of the time, there's no connection between. I mean, Dana knows about Willa, but Willa doesn't know about Dana. But it's so beautifully written. Dana's parts are first person, but the parts that are about Willa are in third person. And it's just this amazing, amazing story about, I mean, taking the Beowulf narrative and the various characters and turns that narrative makes. So if you're familiar with it, the book is playing with your expectations in a lot of ways, and then in a lot of ways you using those expectations it presumes you have to perform various sleights of hand and things like that. So
okay, cool.
I mean, yeah,
well, it's been one on my list, but
it is so good, and it is beautifully written. Her prose is fantastic, and but it's a great book. It is so well put together, and the ambiguity that's threaded through the book in terms of who Dana is, what may or may not have happened to her, but it's not a frustrating ambiguity. And these two women who are in these separate sort of homes. And one is an actual home and like a house, like a very expensive mansion, and she's very well off. And then Dana, who's in this under the mountain, this abandoned place. Just the confrontation that is running through the story, even before they actually confront each other, is really, really well put together. So now, highly, highly recommend. Really, really smart book. You don't have to be familiar with Beowulf, but yeah, actually, it'd be really interesting to know if someone is completely unfamiliar with the Beowulf story, what they thought of the Mere Wife. I found knowing a little bit about Beowulf was quite helpful, but again, I don't think it's absolutely necessary. It's just a really, really good story.
So I'm now going to do my fifth. My family is preparing for lunch behind me, so this will be quite quick.
Yep.
You can probably hear the noise. And it hailed literally 1 minute ago. It was just a hailstorm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it did. So anyway, it's all happening here. So my last thing is also a book. It's one that has just come out for pre-order. Can you guess what it is, Kirsten?
I think it might be the book I just ordered this morning.
Yes.
Is it probably Robert Shearman's?
Yes.
Opus?
So we all hear stories in the dark. Robert Shearman's PS Publishing extravaganza. 9 years in the making. It's 3 volumes. It's got extraordinarily beautiful woodcut-type illustrations from Reggie Oliver. And what it is a choose-your-own-adventure collection, which begins with a prologue about a man who loses his wife. She dies. And he is told, and I'm not going to go through the whole prologue, but he is told essentially that if he follows 101 stories in the correct order, he can resurrect it. Mm-hmm. So at the end of both the prologue and then each story you read are 5 choices. And the choices are predicated on what you've just read. So it will be, for example, the story so one of the stories that I read for when I did the review for Locus, which is out in May, the book's out in April, but the review's out in May. So, it was a Snoopy story about the death of Snoopy. It's called Shaggy Dog Story. It's hilarious. Anyway, so based on that story, there were five questions that this old lady, who's the one who's walking you through these stories, mm-hmm. Asks about that story and what you then want to go on to next. So if you want to do something that's about World War One, because, you know, Snoopy and the Red Baron with the goggles, then there's a story it'll take you to about World War One. If you want to do a story about the structure of jokes, because peanut strips are structured like jokes, it'll take you to a story, etc. So that's how it works. And as a result, it means that every story you read feeds off the story you just read, which means everything is in conversation with each other. And it's happening in real time. It also means because you're choosing between five stories that it is unlikely anyone will choose to read the collection in the way you choose to read it.
Yeah.
In fact, according to the mathematics, which Rob does provide in a secret section in the book, because of course there's a secret section in the book, he does actually provide the mathematics of what the chances of anyone reading the story reading the collection in the order you've read it, anyone reading it in the same order is, which is astronomical.
Okay.
So everyone gets a unique experience in reading this collection. So it just came up for pre-order today as well. We're recording this on 12:30 Saturday afternoon.
And you can't get the Super Deluxe Edition anymore. It's sold out.
Yes, but I obviously pre-ordered as well straight away, and I did not get the Deluxe either, I should say, because that was more because I couldn't afford 150 quid. But it's expensive having to buy presents for your kids every 2 minutes because they're bored because I'm foreign. Anyway, but I did buy it. Of course, I've read it anyway. And, in fact, I've read different iterations of this because Rob's been working on it for 9 years.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a spin-off of what he was doing with Love Songs for the Shy and Cynical, I think it was, or You're Just So Special, whichever his most recent the 2011 collection where he was going to write 100 stories for different people. Anyway, the point is that it's sort of based on that, but it isn't because – the stories that he got me to read this back, I think, in 2017, and I noted that a whole bunch of stories have changed.
Yeah.
So although there's 101 stories in this, he's probably written about 150 to 160 all up.
Wow.
It's insane.
Really important.
But it's amazing.
Really important question.
Yes.
Do I need a magnifying glass to read this book?
No, you don't. No.
Good.
He did send me so I could get the full experience, he sent me PDF galleys of it.
Right.
Because what I got originally didn't have the illustrations, so I wanted to see how it all worked.
Yeah.
It's very easy to – and they're big trade paper volumes.
No,
they're
just
not
mean
small, teeny.
Like his last one, remember, had those pages in there that was like –
oh, you mean, yeah, well, you needed some – no, there's none of that. Although there are – in the inner flaps, there are little mini vignettes. So there's stories everywhere.
That I need a magnifying glass for?
No,
okay.
You don't.
Okay.
No, you don't.
My eyes are even worse now than they were when that came out. So.
Yes. So it has forwards from Michael Marshall Smith, Angela Slatter, and Lisa Tuttle, and a Middlewood, the first ever, from Stephen Moffat.
Okay.
So literally in the – well, it's not literally. It's towards the end of the second volume, Stephen Moffat pops up.
Okay. Middlewood. I like that.
Plus, there is a secret story, which I highly recommend, Kirsten, that you because you have to cheat to get to it.
So by secret story, it's one that's not given as an option at any time?
Correct.
So you just have to go – and it's not in a table of contents?
Correct.
So you just have to go through – oh, he's so tricky.
Correct. But, you have to find it.
But sometimes the tricky's not endearing. It's annoying, like with the tiny, tiny, tiny font.
Which is why I'm telling you. That it's there because it is actually pivotal to the entire thing.
Oh, God.
But
human. Why? Why look, so tricky?
It's, okay. This is a love letter to storytelling. That's what this book is.
Okay. No, I'm really, really looking forward to it because I love Rob Sheeman's work. Love it.
Kirsten, it will not take you long to find the hidden story, all right?
Okay.
It won't.
Is it in a different font?
No, it won't take you long. Trust me.
But should I find it before I read it?
If you can't find
it,
I'll tell you where it is.
But should I find it before I read it or after I read it?
No. It should be the 101st story you read.
Okay.
So if you go through it properly.
So I should read the whole thing and then find the hidden story that I haven't read yet.
Yeah, but you will. Because it's a choose your own adventure book, I'm trying not to spoil this. Because it's a choose your own adventure, you will have probably flicked past it multiple times and go, oh, wait a moment, there's something the penny will drop, Kirsten. You're okay. A very smart person. You're a doctor.
I am a doctor.
He hasn't hidden it in the literal margins of the book, nor is it hidden in like a little loose leaf piece of paper that falls out when you buy the book.
It's just in the collection, but it's not ever given as an option, so you're not going to find it by following the options.
Correct.
Okay, cool. I really look forward to reading that. It makes me sad we're not doing the podcast anymore because we can talk about it.
Well, we could. Once you get it. It could be a special episode.
Oh, God.
We could also do the Mere Wife or whatever, because that would give me an excuse to read it.
You want to do the podcast again?
Maybe not as often as we used to, but maybe. I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to go because my family's about to pull me by the scruff, but I do want to add one little thing.
Okay.
Coot Street Podcast are doing little short podcasts as well. In between Gary and Jonathan meeting together for a fortnight to do their normal podcasts, they're doing 10-minute episodes.
Yes, I've listened to some of them.
With their friends, as they say. And clearly I'm one of them because I was the second and still the longest episode of the 10 minutes. So most of them aren't within 10. Mine was 18 minutes.
Yeah, well, that makes sense because this podcast is meant to be an hour and it's gone for 125. So I probably will edit some out of that too, just to bring it down to maybe I can't get it to an hour, but maybe an hour 15.
Good. So I highly recommend the Coot Street 10 minutes with range because they're getting a lot of great people, a lot of top recommendations, and that's about it for me. I have this urge to mention all these books that are coming out.
Stop.
But I don't want to. Stop. I don't want to leave people out. So yeah.
Well, I tell you what, people can send us feedback. They can either comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, which may be where you found this, or you may have found this on Patreon because our Patreon page is still live. We are not charging money for this podcast. This is just a surprise podcast that will be up on Patreon, but at no cost to our patrons. If there are still patrons, I don't know. Maybe most of you have unsubscribed. You can also send us an email to writerandcritic@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter, which I think Ian may still be monitoring @writerandcritic.
No, I stopped monitoring it about a year ago.
Maybe you need to start again @writerandcritic. on Twitter. But send us feedback. Let us know if you would like more Writer and Critic podcasts because maybe we can do some more. I don't know if we can do one every month again, but maybe we could.
Basically, if I don't see a critical mass of 500 people wanting us to do it.
500. This will be our last podcast then, Ian. All righty.
Okay.
Thank you for listening, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
And, we may or may not
safe
talk to you in the
future. Stay healthy.
Bye. Bye, Ian. Enjoy your lunch.
Bye. Okay.
I feel like I'm not even going to edit this a lot. I feel like I'm just going to leave in coughs and mistakes, and that will be part of the whole pandemic aesthetic. I could get used to the pandemic aesthetic. It's kind of a case of I don't just give a fuck.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's my pandemic aesthetic. I don't give a fuck anymore.